Even before the 7th of October, the situation in West Bank was very dire. 2023 was very difficult for West Bank. We had seen a trend and we expected what was coming in a way because there were many red flags. For instance, the number of massive Israeli Defense Forces incursions into Jenin, Nablus, Tulkarem had all increased. We had seen massive attacks in these camps. We had seen the highest number of killings since the UN had started recording the casualties and injuries in 2005. 2023 was the highest. We had also seen a spike in other violations, for instance, settler violence, excessive use of force by the IDF or unnecessary use of force. House demolitions, house evictions, so on and so forth. After 7th of October, focus shifted to Gaza. Gaza needs that attention, but a number of things happened in West Bank. One, the violations that we were seeing before the 7th of October increased in frequency as well as intensity. So if we talk about the number of people killed, injured, either because of these massive incursions by the IDF into West Bank, particularly in Tulkarem, Jenin, Nablus, sometimes into Jericho and other parts as well, that spiked up. The number of people who were detained from West Bank spiked up massively. There are close to 9,000 people now in detention from West Bank. So while the attention was in Gaza, the intensity and frequency of violations increased in West Bank. Whatever happens in Gaza has a massive impact on West Bank. Whatever happens in West Bank has an impact on Gaza because they're the same people. We see now huge fear among the population of West Bank as well, on a regular basis, worried about incursions, worried about raids, worried about arrest and detention, worried about settler violence. And of course, with massive, significant movement restrictions that impact their day-to-day life.
What are the immediate needs of the population in the West Bank? What concerns you and your colleagues in the UN cluster the most?
Look, first of all, the safety and security of the people there, I think that's extremely important, and that is not being respected. Our biggest concern is the spike in violence that we are seeing, particularly coming from very emboldened settlers. Because the attention is focused on Gaza, they feel emboldened. There's been massive lack of accountability, or in other words, impunity for violations that have been committed by the IDF in West Bank. So they continue to violate. Or continue to attack Palestinians, Palestinian towns and villages. So the lack of safety and security of people is at the topmost concern for us. The Israeli Defense Force is acting as if there is an armed conflict in West Bank. The applicable law in West Bank is the human rights law enforcement framework, which means the force that the IDF can use is limited to that legal framework. In West Bank, there is no armed conflict. But the nature of these operations that are being conducted by the IDF indicate that they're using massive number of soldiers, drones, sometimes fighter jets dropping bombs, shoulder-fired missiles, heavy weapons, in other words, which is used generally in an armed conflict, not in a law enforcement. Other concern is movement restrictions and arrest and detention. People are unable to move between towns, between communities, between cities within West Bank. That has had a major impact on the economy. That has had a major impact on the family structures, the society, more generally, the Palestinian community.
In this situation, when we're speaking about an occupied territory, it is supposed that the occupying power acts as the law enforcement, as the side which is to maintain law and order. But based on what you are describing, it is vice versa. Is that so?
That is correct. And unfortunately, that has been the case. In international law, the responsibility and the obligation to provide protection is of the occupying power, and that is of Israel. and that includes the IDF, is expected to provide safety and security and protect the population of the occupied territory, and that's the Palestinians. However, what we have seen consistently, and that has increased since the 7th of October, is that the IDF ends up providing security to the settlers who are actually attacking Palestinians. Many a times we have found them being bystanders. In many cases, they have facilitated these attacks. In many instances, we have started seeing that the settlers are also wearing IDF clothes, so it's very difficult to distinguish between the two. Unfortunately, IDF and more broadly Israel has not honored their obligation under IHL, but on the contrary, have only committed more human rights violations than IHL violations.
In such circumstances, who is there to protect Palestinians in their rights?
That's a good question. I mean, this is where I think the vacuum comes in. I think in many instances, in many pockets of West Bank as well, there is a vacuum for protection of Palestinians. In cases of settler violence, for instance, the Palestinians are expected to go and file a complaint with the Israeli police or IDF who are inside the Israeli settlements. For me, that doesn't make any sense. When they're attacked by the Israeli settlers, how do you expect a Palestinian to go inside an Israeli settlement, which is already quite scary for them, and go and complain? And when they have seen consistent lack of accountability, why would they do that? So you don't find many Palestinians going in and lodging complaints. In the end, that's what leaves a massive protection gap for Palestinians.
When you are speaking of attacks or any actions by the settlers, what kind of clashes are there? What actions on behalf of settlers are you referring to?
There are many. I mean, we in the past, we used to see one settler attacking a herder or a Palestinian who is probably moving around, etc. What we have seen in 2023 and moving further into 2024, and the trend has continued, is much more organized settlers attacking in groups against Palestinian towns and villages and communities. They coordinate an attack or coordinate gatherings and then attack a community. It can be from stones and sticks to weapons, including firearms and guns, for instance. That's where we have seen in many cases Palestinians being shot, injured, and in many, many cases killed as well. But in many cases where they have attacked a community, particularly a village or a town, we have seen shops, vehicles, houses, the entire community being burnt down. So it has increased both in terms of intensity as well as the frequency of and then the kind of attacks that we have seen over the years.
You mean to say that those are not actions in response to some activity on behalf of Palestinians, but rather something which is organized, coordinated, and even instigated by the settlers themselves?
We have to remember one thing. The settlements over the years have expanded massively, which means settlements and settlers live extremely close or next to the Palestinian community. So constant chance of meeting each other or having frictions, incidents of clashes increase. For instance, if a herder goes to a land which he has been using and herding for many years, and the settlement expands, and then there's a claim by settlers that the land belongs to them, you can expect a clash to happen. And that's exactly what's also sort of happening. So it's a combination of reasons. If there is a trigger, you will have settlers getting together in an organized manner.
In this situation, you do record all those cases, report about them. Do you also interact with Palestinian human rights defender groups, some advocates? How does it work? Are there such groups at all? Are there such groups on both sides, Israel and Palestine? And do you interact with all of them?
That's a very critical question. We record violations, all sorts of violations, not just settler violence, but also house evictions, house demolitions, detention, ranging from economic, social to civil and political rights, all We don't do this on our own either. One of our big functions is to make sure that civil society space is maintained. And we work very closely with a range of organizations, both UN as well as NGOs. And when we talk about NGOs, both national and international, and when we talk about national, both Palestinian as well as Israeli NGOs. And we have established this network over the years, many, many years. What has happened, however, over the last few years is massive shrinking of space for different reasons. And to be honest, it also comes from all sides, all three duty bearers, Israel, PA, as well as the de facto authorities. However, I think much of those restrictions come from Israel. For instance, if I have to give you an example, a couple of years ago, Israel designated with no evidence human rights NGOs as terrorist organization. And but when you do something of that sort, you will have support dwindling to these NGOs, whether we mean it or not, whether we like it or not. And that's a space we are trying to push back, and we are trying to help NGOs do their job. It's extremely important that we are there on the ground and are able to record these violations, not just the UN, but we have to empower the local NGOs. Similarly, and that has had a fear and intimidation impact on NGOs. Similarly, the Israeli NGOs have also faced such threats. For instance, when the Israeli government threatened 65% tax on any incoming funds from abroad, that was in a way to squeeze the space of Israeli NGOs. However, we still, as UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, continue to work with both sets of organizations, give them this confidence that we are there with them, speak to member states not to abandon them, and continue to fund them.
Do you have this experience of being restricted in your movements and getting access to other people? And how often do you manage to go either to the West Bank or to Gaza to speak to people?
Sure. We have equal challenges, or sometimes in many ways more. For instance, you may recall, I mean, OHCHR international staff were refused to be granted visa about 3 years ago, and that still remains the case. So the international staff sit outside and provide support. We have national staff both in Gaza as well as West Bank. The optimal situation would have been us being in Gaza as well as West Bank, along with the national staff. So access for international staff still remains a problem for us. And that has been the case for the last 3 years. And we've been trying to work on it with member states. And the High Commissioner has also been calling on member states to support access and provision of visas. The second aspect is on national staff as well. And this goes beyond OHCHR. I mean, safety and security within West Bank is a major concern. So having access to the community that has been affected is a big problem. With movement restrictions, it makes it even more difficult. Sometimes something that has to take half an hour will take us 3 hours to move in one direction. Just like the population, sometimes the UN is also under attack. It's not necessary that we are completely safe. So we have to bear all those things in mind. So access is an issue for internationals. Access within the community for national staff is also an issue. And safety and security is also something that is of massive issue.
Since October, there's been a number of Gazans who had to stay in the West Bank. So what's the situation with them?
When the 7th of October attacks happened inside Israel, thousands of Gazan workers, Palestinians in Gaza, workers who were in West Bank and Israel were all detained. No one knows the exact number of workers from Gaza who were detained by the Israelis. A number of them were then released through Kerem Shalom, crossing into Gaza. We do not have a full picture of the number of them who were released. We do not have a full picture of number of them who are still in detention. However, those who have been detained, several of them have given us consistent accounts of being ill-treated, humiliated, sexually abused, and tortured. There are many who still remain in detention. I'm not able to give a full picture. What I can say is also they do not have access to ICRC that they used to have in the past. They do not have access to the family. They do not have access to legal recourse. Many of them, we do not know where they have been detained.